weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to the gang on Drive for taking us through the afternoon here on 2FM. It's Thursday the 21st of November and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, we'll be dissecting Andy Farrell's team for the Fiji game with Bernard Jackman. Rebecca Cray's in studio to talk all things football and we'll hear from Eileen Gleeson on her squad for the Euro playoff game against Wales. Plus, Jeff Shepherd has the latest from the world of US sport. And we'll be live to Greg Allen at the National Basketball Arena for updates on Ireland's World Cup qualifier against Azerbaijan. If you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200. And we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. Rebecca Cray is with me in studio. Rebecca, we're going to be getting in to Eileen Gleeson's squad for those games against Wales that are coming up next week and the week after. Really exciting times because the Euros are oh so close, but a huge hurdle to get over with Wales. And a shout out actually to the squad announcement video. It was really nice.
Yeah, really good. Emma Clinton and Danny are doing great things there in the media side of things. But yeah, look, it's definitely within grasp. It feels so close, but yet so far away. Obviously, Wales are a great outfit and we've kind of witnessed that over the course of time. Still have some great players in Jess Fishlock and Angra James and Kerry Holland there as well. So yeah, look, really hard feat, but I'm sure the girls will be well up for it as well.
Yeah, I'd say if you'd asked them even a couple of years ago, would they like to be in this position? Absolutely, the more major tournaments they can get to, the better. We'll get into that a little bit more with Rebecca, but now we are going to cross over to the National Basketball Arena. There's a really big game taking place there, a European pre-qualifier for the World Cup in 2027. It is Ireland against Azerbaijan, and Greg Allen is there for us. Greg, how's it going?
Well, it's going very well for Ireland. They're leading 52-27 at half time. It was 48-25, so a big lead at half five with 23 points, and that's been extended to 25. Really, just to give you some background to this, because it's a must-win game for Ireland in their first ever FIBA World Cup. This pre-qualifying campaign opened with defeats last February against Switzerland and away to Kosovo. The one against Switzerland was a home match for Ireland, so that was a serious defeat. Also losing to Kosovo away, it was a tight match. That also very significant because it means they're bottom of the group. And while Ireland are ranked higher than their opponents here today, Azerbaijan in the world rankings, Azerbaijan actually beat Kosovo last February. So Ireland, as I said, bottom of the group without a point. They have to win here and also at home to Kosovo on Sunday to have any chance of finishing. I think second in the group is all they can really be aiming for now. And that will give them a 1-in-3 chance of progressing to the second round of these pre-qualifiers in the summer. So in the first half, Ireland in apparent control, as I said. They got off to a fantastic start, scoring the first 10 points of the game without a reply. That's been the platform for the position they're in right now, currently 57 points to 30. It doesn't look like there's any way back to Azerbaijan, because in the start of this third quarter, they really had to come out with guns firing, do something that they weren't doing in the first half, because Azerbaijan are much better than this. As I said, they have beaten Kosovo. Kosovo have beaten Ireland. You would expect that Azerbaijan will be much more competitive than 57 to 30 points, a 27-point deficit against Ireland. So it looks like Ireland should get home, barring some sort of extraordinary unforeseen circumstance. Really fine play by Sean Flood in that first quarter, incidentally. He scored 7 points in the first quarter, 13 points on his scoreboard so far. Jordan Blount, he's on 10. John Carroll on 6. Neil Quinn on 6. Ireland have 8 players on the score sheet. A real all-round team effort. They're moving the ball far more swiftly, far more accurately. And Ireland's shooting percentage of 53% is just overwhelming the Azerbaijan shooting percentage of only 23%. It is really a mismatch at the moment in terms of what's happening on court. It is unexpected. We expected Azerbaijan to be serious opposition, but so far Ireland in real control with just 6 minutes left in the third quarter. 16 minutes to go of court time. Ireland 57, Azerbaijan 31.
Thanks so much for that, Greg Allen. More of the same for the rest of the evening. We hope we'll be back to Greg in just a little while. Returning our attention to rugby now. Andy Farrell has made 7 changes to the side that beat Argentina last Friday night, with the debuts for Leinster's Gus McCarthy and Ulster's Cormac Isuchuku. Nace's Jamie Osborne is named at fullback for his first start in green at the Aviva Stadium. He joins Mac Hansen and Jacob Stockdale in the Ireland back back three. Craig Casey partners Prendergast at half back. Bundy Aki comes back in to link up Robbie Henshaw in the centre. And Jacob Stockdale is making his first appearance for Ireland since last year's World Cup warm-up game against Samoa. So loads to get through with Andy Farrell and Michael Corcoran. Chatted him today about his team selection.
Obviously, before any campaign, you have some thoughts in your head, and things obviously change in that regard after you've played a couple of games. But when you weigh everything up and weigh up the series as a whole, what is it that we're trying to achieve? Yes, we want to play well, we want to win, but at the same time, we want to try and make sure we give a few opportunities to people who deserve it.
And a big day and a big week in the life of both Gus McCarthy and Cormac Azzetchigo.
Exactly, and both lads have enormous potential. They've obviously impressed massively. Izzy has been around us now for over a year, been on the emerging island twice and matured massively as a player. What an athlete, and he's grown within the game. He's not been in the game that long, as he was, as we know, a sevens player for a while. But it's a fantastic story, his within itself, and then Gus, obviously coming from the 20s and being successful there, and when an opportunity comes, which there has been certainly at Leinster because of the two hookers, Ronan and Dan being injured. He's stepped up to the mark and played really well, and we had a look at him as a development player, and you know we was nursing a few injuries at the time, and he got more time probably than he would have expected in training, in the team, etc. And he's shown up unbelievably well, so we're excited to see them ball.
Does that show the benefit of the Emerging Ireland Tour? I mean, at the time, people, I know when it takes place, people complain and grumble about, you know, it takes people away. But, you know, we've seen how people have progressed from an Emerging Ireland Tour to get involved in the senior team.
Well, to us, it's a must that we find opportunities to find a way to expose these young players who's talented, who need to push on and push through. We need to give them exposure. The URC Pro 12, Pro 14, it used to be different. You know, they used to get plenty of exposure, but the way that the league is run now, things have changed. So we need to keep finding avenues to be able to do that. And yes, it's uncomfortable for everyone at the time, but we need to keep pushing the depth chart, not just in regards to the Emerging Ireland, but other avenues as well.
Are you looking for a more composed performance in terms of discipline on the pitch and just being that bit more, you know, haven't had more time together?
Well, we need to be, that's for sure. The opposition that we're playing will tell you that, because, you know, if it's loose, if it's a bit stop-start, you know, I suppose, if there's plenty of turnover ball, then I suppose it's playing into their hands, because that's the strength, isn't it? The athletic nature that they've got and the physicality that they've got throughout the side. So, yeah, it's continuity with our performance is something that we've been chasing.
And can you just talk about the danger and the threat that Fiji pose? I mean, it was 19 points each after 60 minutes against Spain, yet they put them away kind of comfortably enough looking at the scoreboard and having watched the match.
Well, I mean, you know, the reality is that they've made 12 changes to that team. So I think the relevance is the victory there in Cardiff, and not just that, the victories that they've had over the last 2 years in regards to England and, you know, taking on Australia, etc. This side is, because of the Drua side being involved in Super Rugby, and all of the players playing top-level rugby, whether it be in the UK or over in France or elsewhere, they have come on leaps and bounds in their consistency over the last couple of years.
Ireland head coach Andy Farrell speaking to Michael Corcoran about his team to play Fiji at the weekend. Returning our attention back to football now, Rebecca Cray is with me in studio. Rebecca, the Wales game, it's going to come around really quickly. Eoin Gleeson naming her squad today. An exciting time, I mentioned at the top, but a little bit of apprehension as well, because we know there isn't too much separating these two sides when it comes to calibre of players anyway.
Yeah, most definitely, really equally matched across the board. You know, we've got girls playing at similar levels on both sides. I know in the previous meeting of the two in February, there was a 2-0 defeat for ourselves, you know, to Wales. And I think the last time we met was 2022 before that, and we actually beat them 1-0. So look, I think given the summer that we've had and the games we've had against such a, you know, great oppositions in England and France, and obviously coming out the better side of the France game as well, we'll stand to the girls. And I think that was mentioned by Eoin Gleeson today, you know, in conversations with media, that those are the performances, although they weren't great in terms of results, but the performances most definitely will stand to us. So yeah, look, fast approaching, only about 9 days away now, so yeah, really looking forward to it.
You mentioned that friendly game that Ireland lost to Wales. That was back in February. Eoin Gleeson was asked today could she assess how little separates the sides and how well prepared her squad are for this two-legged playoff. Let's hear from Eoin Gleeson now.
It's a very evenly matched tie. I think in terms of squad profile and the level that girls play on, it's nearly identical. But yeah, they're a strong team. You know, we played them in February. They beat us well in February. So we know they've got strength and depth, some really strong key players like ourselves. So I think it's going to be a very evenly matched tie. We had a really strong group that we were part of in the qualifying group. But yeah, there's lots of learning in that. Playing against England, France and Sweden. We learned where our limitations were against the level of those teams, but we also, you know, learned how to be really resilient and hard to beat and difficult to break down. And you know, these are really important learnings from us against playing oppositions like that. And then we also learned how to get results towards the end of it. So yeah, really, really valuable experiences.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And in fairness to Eoin and the squad, they have evolved quite a lot since then, and a different looking team. But when you look at who she has available to her, still a few players out, but some back. Do you think she'll be feeling in credit when you look and you see that the likes of Rusha Littlejohn, Megan Campbell, Megan Connolly are back, but she's still without Louise Quinn?
Yeah, look, you know, the likes of Louise Quinn, she's a stalwart on the side, you know, and she's been there for X amount of years. I won't mention the amount, but yeah, really great figure to have around. But she still has got great, you know, calibres of players, and Niamh Fahey involved still, and you know, Katie McCabe obviously is there as captain, with Rusha Littlejohn coming back in, Megan Connolly and obviously Megan Campbell as well. It gives that level of experience, just brings that up slightly, and obviously you have got that threat of Megan Campbell's throw in. So look, if those girls can stay fit over the course of the next 2 weeks, brilliant. You know, it's only a plus for the side, and I think they're worlds away from where we left off, you know, at the end of the last round. It seems to be such a positivity within the group, and you can kind of see that, you know, in interviews and, you know, in pictures online and things like that. I know you can only take so much from that, but there seems to be a nice little vibe throughout the camp, and it's definitely shown in the way they're playing in the last few games.
So what about Wales then? Rhian Wilkinson was the new manager. She was a new manager when the two sides met back in February. She's had time herself with her squad. She named a 26 player squad yesterday. Jess Fishlock, who hopefully won't have the same influence in Tala Stadium over the next couple of games that she did that day, because we just couldn't seem to handle her. But what are their threats?
Yeah, look, you named obviously Jess there. She's 37 and still banging them in. You know, you'd never ever know. But likes of herself, obviously, really good. You know, she makes them tick in midfield. She's a bit like Denise O'Sullivan in that sense. You know, obviously, she's got a decent enough season out in Seattle as well. But likes of herself, obviously, Captain Angra James has been really good and really consistent for them over the course of the last decade or so. Kerry Holland, obviously, is another player from Liverpool, who is fantastic in domestic football. And she's definitely a standout and is a goal threat as well. So they've got a good kind of core midfield there that we'll need to keep an eye on. And look, I think it's a case that you think back to the Scotland game when we qualified for that World Cup. it's not too much different, you know, in terms of the levels, you know, within the squads. But I think these games are going to come down to just who wants it that bit more, you know, a little bit of heart. And I think what's at the end of it will definitely drive both on.
They haven't qualified for a major tournament, have they?
Wales, no, I don't think so.
Yeah,
so there you go. You know, so it's very much, you know, it's very much evenly matched. So I think we're going to be in for a real treat now come next
week. Yeah, I'm glad now that we'll be sitting on the sidelines watching it, because
it's nearly worse.
Say you're going to be expending a huge amount of energy, but like even the concentration that's going to be required, because they're so similar in levels of ability and kind of levels that they're playing at. They have their few players at the really top level, and then they kind of go down then to the championship and things like that. And just in terms of selection then, we've obviously seen this team up close and personal for the last few months under Eileen. Where do you think she has headaches?
Looking at the squad she's brought in, you know, like that midfield is just, you know, jam-packed. I think, and in terms of the back line, I think Jessie Stapleton gave a real good account of herself. Mm-hmm. I know obviously the Georgia games, you can't really, you know, kind of weigh up too much given that they weren't the best opposition, but I thought she'd done really well when she did play, and obviously had a part to play in Kyra Cruz's goal for, you know, the flick as well. So I think that midfield though, pack, obviously Megan Connolly is coming back in there, you know, trying to figure out where she slots in. Obviously same with Ruta Littlejohn. But I'd like to think it's that midfield pack that she'll have her challenges.
Yeah, and Eileen has her own challenges at the moment as well, because it is contract negotiation time for yes. Eileen. So it expires at the end of the current qualification campaign. So that means Tuesday week's game against Wales at the Aviva could be the last of her time in charge of the Republic of Ireland. She also spoke today of her enjoyment in the job, and she says she talks with the FAI's Chief Football Officer Mark Canham regarding her future. They're not her current priority, and that's fair. Let's hear from Eileen on that.
Mark and I speak all the time. We've a really positive, you know, relationship, but no discussions around contract. I want to keep all focus. I don't have the capacity to focus on anything else, only Wales. That's all we think about. So yeah, no formal discussions now. You know, I'm not really thinking about myself and what the games are. I'm thinking about the playoffs and thinking about getting the players ready. And then post the games, I think, you know, then we'll be able to talk about conversations around that. But, yeah, I'm trying to keep all my brain power for these games.
It's understandable, really, because these games are so huge. And if it all goes to plan, like, she's in a very envious position to be able to negotiate having qualified for Euros. If it doesn't go well, then look, who knows, but like, she's done a good job, hasn't she, Rebecca?
I think so. Look, I think it's been positive since she's come in. She's hasn't had a kind of easy run of it either this year, you know, obviously playing France and Sweden and England, all these really good, you know, teams across Europe. And look, I think she can hold her head high in the approach she's had and the kind of personnel she's brought in around her. She's been quite good at recognising that, look, she doesn't know everything maybe, and, you know, she's got people there to lean on. And in Emma Byrne, obviously, who has great experience in Irish setups and obviously has coached in England and things like that. And obviously Colin Healy has been, I think, someone that she's relied on heavily as well. So look, she's got a great team behind her. You can understand that she's given her full focus to these two games. They're probably the two most important games that she'll ever be involved in, you know, in getting us to maybe our next major tournament. But yeah, look, I think a lot is to play for over the course of these two games, and whether she either, you know, hangs around as the senior women's coach or she moves on.
Yeah, well, she'll always be in women's football anyway. We know that for sure.
Yeah.
Whatever,
I don't think she'll ever get away from that.
Yeah, it's an interesting time domestically here for the Women's National League. A lot of movement on the managerial front. Ken Kiernan today was confirmed as going in with Ciarán Kilduff as assistant in Dundalk. The Bohemians' job is vacant. There's a few vacancies now,
yeah.
Rebecca.
Yeah, most definitely. Obviously, Treaty fulfilled theirs down there in the last few months. And obviously, there's Bows that are still free of a manager. Wexford are the same, you know, and obviously Piemont as well. So it's been a lot of chopping and changing over the course of the last few months. And I think, you know, this next 2 month period will be interesting to see who fills the boots of the people gone before them.
Yeah, and you're obviously involved on the ground with Shelburne and are very aware of the coaches out there. What's the calibre like? Are we seeing an improvement in coaching?
I'd like to think so, yeah. You only look at, obviously, Kieran Kilduff's reign at that loan. You know, he's done magnificently well and obviously has brought in a real professionalism throughout the league, and as well with Owen Wearing at Shells with ourselves. You know, they expect the highest standards, and you know, the sessions that they've both put on, like I've seen, have been really of a high calibre. And even Laura Heffernan, I should say, sorry, out in DLR, you know, the only female really holding the fourth as well. She's done great things for them. And yeah, the levels are very high, and look, you want to try and retain those kind of coaches in women's football. Obviously, unfortunately, Kilduff, you know, headed off to Dundalk, same with Ken Kieran, and has now left his post at Bowes to go back to go to the men's game, I should say. But look, hopefully there's a few more coming through. And I always mention my own pals in Pearl Slattery and Rachel Graham, mm-hmm. you know, two UEFA A licensed coaches, you know, who have got probably a huge future in coaching ahead, you know, to come. So there's definitely good coaches throughout the league that are yet to get involved.
Yeah, busy. Few coaches who are busy playing football as well.
Exactly.
Rebecca, thank you so much for all of that. We're going to go back to the National Basketball Arena now to Greg Allen, who is watching Ireland versus Azerbaijan. How's it going now, Greg?
Yeah, just a short stoppage in play with 0.7 of a second to the end of the third quarter. So I think we can safely say that unless this is going to go to the free throw line, which it looks like it might, Ireland will be leading 71-44, 45 or 46 when this third quarter hooter goes in a moment. Azerbaijan at the free throw line. But look, this has been an unexpectedly one-sided game from the very off. In fact, as I'm speaking, yet another miss by Azerbaijan, this one from the free throw line, and that has just been their Achilles heel. They've had plenty of ball in hand and their shooting percentages are below 30%. It really has been a very off day for them. Ireland scored the first 10 points without reply in the first 3.5 minutes, led by 13 at the end of the first quarter. They led by 23 at halftime, 48-25. And as I said, the shooting percentages in the first half were even worse for Azerbaijan than they are now. Actually, this third quarter has been far and away their best quarter, but Ireland have nipped it by a point. So a 13-point lead after the first quarter, 25 after the second quarter, that was halftime, and now it's a 26-point lead for Ireland, 71-45, and Ireland driven on by example by their captain, Sean Flood, a real buzzing shooting forward, shooting guard player who absolutely has been on fire for most of this game, 24 points, far and away the top scorer in the game. Barring some sort of disaster, it's Ireland who are going to win. They're 71-45 ahead, but literally this is a must win because they're bottom of the group. Azerbaijan are lower than them in the world rankings. Ireland have home advantage. We just didn't expect it to be quite so one-sided. And of course, Ireland have Kosovo to face on Sunday. That's also a must-win. Azerbaijan beat Kosovo. So they're all very evenly matched.
Before the programme finishes, we're going to go back to football now. And there was it has been widely reported that Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola has agreed a contract extension with the option of a further year until 2027. We're joined now by Sam Lee. Sam is the Manchester City correspondent with The Athletic and also presenter of the Let Me Talk podcast, which is dedicated to the club. How are you, Sam?
Hi, yeah, I'm very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, yeah. Thank you so much for taking our call about Pep Guardiola. So what does this mean for Manchester City, the fact that he has committed to the club?
I think it's just good news going forward. We know they're changing sporting director in the summer, so if they'd been changing the sporting director and the manager at the same time, that would have obviously been a little bit harder. But with Guardiola being there and being as good as he is, we know that wherever he's been, whether that's Barcelona, Bayern or City, his team's always at the top level, and generally they win at least the league title at the end of it. So if you've kind of got not that assurance, but confidence that you're going to be performing well on the pitch over the course of the season, it kind of helps everything smooth over in terms of other areas of the club. And I just think, generally speaking, having a manager that good for as long as possible is obviously a good thing. So for City to get him for 1 year, with possibly another one after that, it's perfect for them, really.
Yeah, and I'd imagine as well, just in terms of players around as well, that if anyone is thinking about leaving or staying, that his decision will influence their decisions too.
Yeah, well, when they signed Erling Haaland a couple of years ago, some of the clauses in his contract were seemingly linked to Guardiola's future, because there was some doubt at that point if he was going to be around for too much longer. But obviously now he is. City is still trying to get Haaland to sign a new contract, so that would presumably strengthen their hand there. But you've also got situations where, hypothetically, if any players were thinking, I don't know, I could do with a bit of a change, I'm not really sure about the manager, let's see how the next year goes, maybe if he goes, I'll stay. But now they know that he's staying, it's like, okay, well, I've got to, you know, he's in charge, he's still here, I'm going to have to do what he says, otherwise that's it, I won't play. So, again, Guardiola's not always been like the most popular manager with the players, you know, because he's so intense, it can be very demanding, but you very ever rarely see those problems boil over into an actual thing behind the scenes, and on the pitch, almost never. Whenever those players go on the pitch, they do what he tells them to, and it always seems to work out. So, yeah, in that sense, it is going to help with a lot of the players as well.
Is it an indication as well that he or the club believe that the charges they're facing aren't going to stick?
Well, I think if we imagine that this week Guardiola and City had announced that he was going to leave at the end of the season, I think the general assumption, I think it would have been talked about quite a lot on social media, maybe even the media, the general assumption would have been that the charges weren't going to go well for City and that's why Guardiola's leaving. I don't think that necessarily would have been true. So obviously now that he is staying, it makes sense that people are saying, oh, well, maybe the charges have gone well for City and that's why he's staying. In a sense as well, I don't think that's true either. I think the reality is that with all the people on the football side at City, whether that's the sporting director, the manager, the players, they've been told since day one, since these like the rumours started circulating, the leaks, and obviously charges, not just from the Premier League this time, but from UEFA, when they got banned from the Champions League, the message to all of those football people was the club's done nothing wrong and they're going to prove their name, but they're going to clear their name. So all the football people have been carrying on as normal, and it's not a decision. You know, footballers who signed for City, you know, it's not a consideration for them. There's no clauses in any of the contracts, as far as I know, that are, you know, related to if they're found guilty. The sporting director is not leaving because of the charges. He's leaving because he's 60 years old and he wants to go and live back in Spain. You know, Guardiola is not staying because the charges have gone well. He's staying because of the sporting challenge. So I think that's the situation with that.
He obviously has a lot of confidence in the squad that he has and whatever plans he has for rebuilding as well, particularly with Rodri's injury.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. Like, in the last couple of weeks, obviously City have lost four games in a row and they lost in the Champions League at Sporting in Lisbon, and I was there when he was asked about taking over Brazil, and he was like, look, now more than ever, I'm excited by the challenge of getting the team back to the top, and he said that a couple of times, and they're not in a very strong space at the moment. But I think for me, a lot of that is down to injuries. He obviously does, like you say, he feels confident that these players are still fighting. They're still good enough, obviously, to challenge and win trophies. Obviously, without Rodri, I don't know, for me, in my opinion, I feel like they might need to add a bit of physicality and mobility in midfield, because they can look a little bit weak when they don't have the ball. And that's obviously something that Rodri gives them that they're missing. But overall, whether it's this season or going into next season as well, yeah, he obviously does feel that his players are still listening to him and responding to his challenges. Otherwise, quite simply, he wouldn't have stayed. Is that the players have given up, he'd have gone. That's always kind of been the biggest yardstick for him.
And what do you think was the carrot elsewhere, or was there one, do you think? Like, if you could see him doing something, I know you mentioned Brazil there. Is that what you think he could do next, or do you know?
Yeah, well, everything points towards him managing a national team next. He's always said he wanted to do that. England tried to get him, but that didn't happen for whatever reason. I think Brazil have been trying to get him. And until recently, I kind of assumed that if he had left City at the end of this season, he'd have a year in charge of a national team, and then it takes him up to the World Cup in America. But then you kind of think, would a year be enough for his preparations, and the fact that he'd only get four opportunities to work with his players in that year? So you start to think now, well, maybe if he does leave City in 2026, for example, which would be after the extra year that he's just signed rather than two, he's got a full four-year cycle then to build something. And that's probably how I would want to do it. You probably wouldn't want to go into a World Cup feeling underprepared. So, yeah, my guess would be, just based on what he said about wanting to manage the national team next, and the fact that I think managing another club after City would be difficult, I'd guess that, say, if he leaves in 26 or 27, he'd then have 3 or 4 years at managing the national team to take them to the 2030 World Cup.
Okay, so it could be interesting a few years post 2027. Sam Lee, thank you so much for all of that. Always interesting on Pep Guardiola and what the future holds. We're going to turn our attention to athletics now, because the National Athletics Awards took place in Dublin last night as a sport gathered to mark a very memorable year across so many disciplines. While there was much to celebrate, 2024 will also be a year that some will want to consign very much to history, particularly Ciara Magean. She was last night honoured as Middle Distance Athlete of the Year, having won gold in the women's 1500 metres at the European Championships in Rome in June. Her dreams of competing at a third Olympics were ended by an Achilles injury, which forced her to withdraw from the Games on the eve of her heats in Paris. Ciara discusses that and much more in a wide-ranging interview, and at times emotional one, which will be broadcast on Saturday Sport on Radio 1 this coming weekend. She recounts sitting in the athlete's village with Thomas, her boyfriend and training partner, as the realisation dawned on her that her body would not be able to endure competing at the Paris Games, and also the motivation she carries to run in LA and emulate her late coach, Gerry Keenan. Let's get a flavour now of that interview that we'll hear in full on Saturday.
Chatting to my physio after, he nearly said, you know, you were a victim of your own success. It was nearly the worst thing to happen to you that you were so successful over the past few years, because I knew 5 years ago I needed surgery on this ankle. I chatted to the very consultant who did the surgery, and he said, yeah, you need surgery on it, but you're running too well for me to open you up. And I was running PBs and I was taking on the world, so I wasn't going to stop. I was going to keep going until I was forced to stop. And yeah, unfortunately for me, that was the Olympic Games this year. And it's heartbreaking, because I don't know why it couldn't have been 2 weeks after. Put me out of some diamond leagues, I wouldn't have minded. But no, it put me out of the Olympic Games. And I sat in the village, having flown in to have 2 injections into my ankle to try to get this settled down, to see if I could toe the line. Injections that previously I was told not to get because it was too much of a risk. But when you're a week out of an Olympic Games, you take these risks. You say it's worth it to try to toe the line because this is my life's work. But it wasn't just pain at that point. I was running and the function of my ankle just wasn't there. I couldn't toe off. When I put my foot down, it just fell flat. So I couldn't even lie to myself and say it was okay, despite trying. Believe you me, I was trying. So I sat down the day before, having talked to the doctor, and asked, is there anything else that you can do? Is there any other adjuncts that we can add? And the doctor said, look, there isn't. We've explored all the avenues. So a teary me sat beside Thomas in the village and made the decision to withdraw from my third Olympic Games. Not going to get emotional. I phoned the doctor, even though I was in the village. I phoned him and said, I'll walk over. I've made my decision. Thomas needed to take a moment away because he didn't want me to see him cry. I phoned my family and told them that I was withdrawn, which is really tough because they had flown all the way to watch their daughter race at the Olympics. And yeah, I gave up on that dream then. But I'm going to compose myself. I sat down with Thomas and he put his arm around me and he said, you won your gold medal in Rome, and Italy had a special place for Gerry. LA was his Olympics, so we're going to focus on that. So my dream may have been dashed, but in that moment, I firmly set my sights on the next 4-year cycle, that won't be the last memory I have of the Olympic Games, that I'm going to go out on my terms. So I went to the doc, I told him I was withdrawn. He told me to take a few days, and I came back and I said, let's arrange the surgery, because the world champs are in a year's time. The sooner I get surgery, the sooner I recover. And this next 4-year cycle is on.
That was Ciara Magean, a very emotional Ciara Magean speaking to Greg Allen. You can hear that full interview on Saturday Sport. It is worth tuning in for. Ciara goes through so much with Greg and also has so much to look forward to as well. We're going to take a very quick break here on Game On, but do stay with us. We'll be heading back over to the National Basketball Arena. We're also going to be talking rugby with Bernard Jackman, and we have our usual Thursday segment of US Sports.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We heard from Andy Farrell at the top of the programme about his team to play Fiji. I'm delighted to say that Bruno Jackman joins me now on the line to go through the team that Farrell has selected. Lots of changes, 7 in total, Bernard, so that means lots of opportunities.
Yeah, great opportunity and first cap for Gus McCarthy, the hooker who's just living his best life at the moment. Would have probably started the summer looking at Dan Sheen and Kelleher and the players ahead of him at Leinster and saying, oh, if I can just get some game time in the URC. And now he's in 6 games, he's managed to force his way into starting a test match in November. And he's a quality player. Look, I've seen him since he's 15 or 16. And I think he'll take it in the stride. He's very like Dan Sheen in terms of how he plays. Obviously he's not as big, but I think it's an opportunity that he will grasp and give us more depth at hooker. Obviously Sam Prendergast getting a start now, having made his debut last week, but then he has, you know, the luxury of having Robbie Henshaw and Bundiaki outside him. You know, Craig Casey gets a chance to start, but he's not an inexperienced player at all now, so he's got protection both sides of him. Osborne has been brilliant off the bench the last couple of weeks, gets a chance to play a fullback where obviously he played in the summer and has looked like he's a test player, so that's great. Stockdale gets a chance to play, having been in the wilderness for a little while, but being some glimpses of his old form for Ulster. And then I suppose probably I'm probably surprised to see, you know, Porter and Doris go back out again. You know, it's going to be hard. It's the first time Farrell in a while has had 4 test games in November, and given how Australia are look like they're back under Joe Schmidt, there certainly is an argument that maybe, you know, he could have been a little bit more extreme even in terms of the rotation he made. But he doesn't give out caps easily, and he has freshened it up without being too radical.
Yeah, it sounds like from listening to you that you feel there's still enough balance there.
Oh, look at it for sure. I mean, you know, Gus McCarthy has, I mentioned, you know, Sam having support either side of him. Gus has Porter and Beelum, with Joe McCarthy and Ty Byrne. I mean, that's a, you know, that's 4/5 of a first choice front five, you know, if anything's wrong with Ty Furlong. So that's brilliant. Obviously back row, he's brought in Cormac Izichukwu, who has excelled and really excited in his game time for Ulster. Obviously he was part of that Emerging Ireland tour. I think what we're seeing is some players who went in that Emerging Ireland tour to South Africa a month and a half ago, likes of Izichukwu, likes of Gus McCarthy, likes of Sam Prendergast, who certainly impress the coaches and are now getting a reward for that. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant to see. I think we all know that Farrell and Simon Easterby, before Farrell comes back from the Lions, is going to have to do a little bit of a job of finding some new blood. And this is a sign that he wants to have a look at some players and the players we already mentioned.
Is that the goal now, do you think, just maybe given the fact that we didn't see the fluidity maybe that we expected in the first 2 games, that unearthing, I guess, reasonable replacements is the goal for the end of this series?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think for sure, you know, a big, powerful athlete like Izichukwu, he's exciting, whether that's starting or off the bench. I mean, Ryan Baird was supposed to be, you know, giving us that last week against Argentina, but so unlucky to get a HIA nearly immediately after he comes on and has to leave the field. So Izichukwu is a similar type of player, and that's a positive. I probably would have thought Jack Boyle at Loosehead might have got a run, but they're looking at Tom O'Toole on the bench covering Loosehead, which obviously if you've got Beelum and Ty Furlong fit, O'Toole then gives you an alternate to Keane Healy, who now it looks like is being kept back for next weekend to break Brian O'Driscoll's record and in what is a historic match for the RFU to mark 150 years. So Farrell is big into I suppose marking significant achievements and breaking the Irish cap record is obviously that. But look, I think even with the changes, Farrell will expect the team to be a lot more fluid for longer than they were against Argentina. The first 20 minutes were excellent, but then we really stuttered in fits and starts to kind of play, and he'll expect more from his team. So and traditionally the longer teams are longer Andy Farrell teams are in camp, the more cohesive they look. So, yeah, I think he won't be tolerant of a scrappy performance, even though there has been, as you said, seven changes.
It's interesting just getting to hear some of the outside views now on this Ireland team, given the fact that they haven't reached peak performance yet. David Campisi has said that teams are starting to rumble Ireland now and that they need to adapt quickly or else they'll fall apart. Do you think that's fair?
Look, I think David Campisi a few weeks ago was saying Joe Schmidt was the wrong man for Australia. But look, I think there definitely is a fear that, on based on the two games so far, and it's a very small pool sample pool size, we haven't looked as good. And I am concerned that the way the referees are allowing the teams defending to counter ruck and to char or to slow down opposition ball, which Ireland are doing as well. So it's not saying they're breaking laws. It's actually making it harder to have three or four quick phases in succession, which obviously Ireland were brilliant at. So that could be something that a law interpretation takes away an area of strength for ours. We obviously have been really poor in the aerial contests. There was 14 high balls put up against Argentina that we didn't get back. And if you win back four or five of those, it gives you territory, it gives you position, and it takes away the stress that has seen us having to defend for more than we would like and give away penalties defending. And so our penalty count and our inability to win high balls, you know, we've given away 13 penalties in both games, a couple of yellow cards, that suddenly starves you of possession, gives the opposition momentum and makes your job a lot harder. So there's a few different creeks that are a few things that have cost us opportunities or chances to play our game, and once we start to fix some of those, I think we look like a different team.
Let's move across the water now, and I know you're so familiar with the landscape in Wales. Warren Gatland is very much under the spotlight at the moment, Bernard, but he says he wants to continue as the Wales head coach to play in South Africa on Saturday. Things haven't been going the way he wants them to go, though. Do you think that he's going to hang on to his job?
Look, it's a tough one. The WRU are cash-strapped. They brought Warren back because they felt his status in the game, his understanding of Welsh rugby, would get a lift out of the players. And to be fair, when he had those players for the summer, you know, they had a very good World Cup. Now, four or five of those big-name players have moved on and they look so shallow in terms of depth. They look unfit, and he's challenged at fitness levels. Coming from the regions, there's so much going on in Welsh rugby and off the field, and there's not a lot of positives on the field. Like to ship 50 points against Australia and then the next week and lose to Fiji the week before and now face South Africa, and I think it's 11 games. It'll be the first time ever they go a whole calendar year without a win. Gatlin was interesting. Post-match, he looked like a broken man, and the sense I had listening to him was, you know, it's just a matter of having a phone call and a meeting and agreeing a compensation figure. And then this week, since then, he's come out and fighting and saying, look, he doesn't have a break clause in his contract, so effectively he's contracted until next World Cup and he intends to stay there. So, yeah, it may be just negotiation tactics. I mean, the Welsh public, there was only 50-odd thousand there at the weekend. They would have budgeted for, you know, full house against Australia, they're probably even less against the world champions, and suddenly you're losing 25,000 people on your gate. Getting rid of the coach is a cheaper option often, and may just breathe a little bit of life into the players or the Welsh public. So it's a tricky time for him, and I hate his legacy to be, you know, going out being sacked, because he has had a huge amount of success in Wales, probably more than he should have, really. I mean, he was amazing at getting some of the parts and some of the regions to be successful at international level and Grand Slams and Six Nations, but maybe it's all going to come to an end.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound good for English rugby as well. It's been widely reported that they are going to announce huge losses, looking at around 40 million, around that anyway, Bernard, which is a lot.
Yeah, look, it's incredible, and I don't know if many people know this, but the senior players at the moment are trying to renegotiate their match fees for more money, and it's a bit tone deaf because, you know, there's been a lot of redundancies in the RFU. The cost of rebuilding Twickenham spiraled out of control, or renovating it, and now they've, you know, they've sold their naming rights. I think they got 100 million off Allianz over 10 years, but they're still going to have a deficit of the guts of 40 million. So yeah, when you think of the three Welsh, or the three UK English teams went out of business, and now you see the debt at governing body level, and you see a team struggling to win as well, and they're on a bad run as well. Yeah, it's not great for the game.
No, definitely not. Brian Jackman, thank you for all of that. We'll be talking to you again soon. We're going to go back to the National Basketball Arena because it is all over between Ireland and Azerbaijan. How did it finish, Greg?
Well, must-win game it was, and Ireland have won 91-67. Very easy win. Understandably, the intensity of the final quarter, nothing like the first three. Ireland had that fast start, 10 points on the board without reply from the start. They carried a 13-point lead at the end of the first quarter. It was a 23-point lead at the end of the second quarter at half-time. And they had this extraordinary shooting percentage by comparison, it has to be said, to Azerbaijan. 53% for Ireland, only 26% for Azerbaijan. And that just tells everything you really need to know. And it's interesting because Azerbaijan were expected to be much better than this. They showed that in defeating Kosovo last February, and Ireland lost to Kosovo last February. But to coin a phrase, Ireland were ruthlessly efficient here. Maybe Mark Keenan, the coach, has got this team a bit more in the right vein of mind for what is a huge task over the next few days, because they face Kosovo on Sunday here in the National Arena, and they need to win that as well to have any chance of progressing in terms of qualifying for the second round of the World Cup. Ireland were driven forward today by the brilliant captain Sean Flood, 26 points, 18 of those came from the three-point area, and also Jordan Blountyn, 13 points, and 7-foot-tall Neil Quinn, they both had 13 points, and really Ireland were just dominant start to finish, and they've won 91-67.
For that, Greg Allen at the National Basketball Arena, finally poised for next Sunday, that's for sure. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be talking US sports after these. Welcome back. It's time to talk US sports. Jeff Shepherd is with us on the line. How are you, Shep?
I'm great, Marie. How are you doing tonight?
Good. You've had a dramatic few days. Chiefs' unbeaten streak has ended, but what a battle it was between Mahomes and Allen. A real treat.
Yeah, and look, we talked last week, Marie, that we thought this is, you know, very likely, you know, two of the top three teams in the AFC in a potential AFC championship, you know, preview or a playoff preview, and it lived up to the hype. Look, you know, the Bills take a lead on the final play of the second quarter, and they lead the final two quarters, never relinquish that lead. Josh Allen, an incredible touchdown run to ice the game at the end, and then they get an interception of Patrick Mahomes. And look, you know, we also talked about, Marie, about how the Chiefs had just kind of been inventing ways to win, right? Blocking field goals and, you know, not looking great. They didn't play, you know, poorly by any stretch of the imagination. The Bills are good, and the Bills in Buffalo are a really good football team, and it's a tough place to play. It ends a 15-game winning streak for the Chiefs. Patrick Mahomes said afterwards, hey, it's cool to be undefeated this late in the season, but that's not what you play for. They're playing for the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, he's got the right attitude. And again, neither of those teams are going anywhere. They're going to be a top two or top three seed, both of them in going into the playoffs. And so they'll both be contending for the Super Bowl title.
Yeah, for sure. And they put on such a great show. Let's move to the New York Jets. So how dysfunctional are they? Could things get any worse?
I mean, nothing could get worse than what happened to start the season last year. But I mean, this is basically the opposite of that, is that Aaron Rodgers is playing and they're not any good. I mean, it's not that they're, oh, they're missing a guy or something's not going on. I mean, they're just not good. And his winning percentage is lower than Zach Wilson's was, you know, who they had to get rid of to make room for Aaron Rodgers. You know, there's a lot of, you know, internal turmoil going on. You know, they fired Robert Saleh last month. They fired the offensive coordinator this week. They've brought in all the players that Aaron Rodgers wants to be around there. It's kind of like, what are we doing here? You know, it's kind of obvious what the issue is. They're 3-8, Marie. You know, I'm just kind of thinking about this. They've got the same record as the New England Patriots, and no one thinks the New England Patriots are anywhere close to turning things around, and they're struggling, you know, first-year quarterback in Drake May and, you know, new coach replacing Bill Belichick. There's no difference between the Jets and the Patriots. I mean, they're both just real bad football teams. Now you have all this discussion about meddling with the owner and Woody Johnson. And, you know, did he want to have Rodgers benched earlier in the season? So they don't have a lot of answers. And it's just real bad football being played right now for both teams in the New York area.
Yeah, tell us about the Giants then.
So Daniel Jones, you know, by no stretch of the imagination has he been, you know, a great NFL quarterback. He managed to get them to the playoffs a couple of years ago and has kind of been riding that momentum. Well, they've been really bad, and the Giants themselves have made some poor front office decisions when it comes to Daniel Jones. They could have franchise tagged him a couple of years ago, and they didn't. So they wound up having to pay him a whole lot more money, and so they wanted to play him, and they didn't win a lot of football games. Well, they've now benched him, and they're going to bring back Tommy DeVito, who kind of sparked them a little bit last year as much as one possibly could for a losing team. But now, you know, they owe Daniel Jones $23 million of guaranteed money if he gets injured. And so, I mean, there's no good answers. There's a lot of really bad quarterback and really bad football play going on in the greater New York area. But quite honestly, Marie, I mean, that's how it's been most of my life. Let's be honest.
So. Yeah, true. Why change the habit of a lifetime? Jeff Shepherd, thank you so much for all of that. That is it from us here this evening. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll be looking ahead to all of the weekend sport.